Even if your only exposure to archaeology is from the Indiana Jones movies, you know there's a fair amount of digging involved. Today's society is often built quite literally atop older ones, which means digging to find the artifacts that help tell the stories of earlier people. But with today's modern technology, it's not all about digging. In fact, satellites thousands of miles above the Earth can help. We learn how from a book by Sarah Parcak called Archaeology from Space, How the Future Shapes Our Past. Sarah Parcak is a professor of anthropology at the University of Alabama, Birmingham. She's also the founder and president of Global Explorer, which crowdsources space archaeology analysis, and she won the $1 million TED Prize for 2016. Sarah Parcak, thanks for visiting us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
You win the prize, by the way, for the best first sentence of the year, "My entire life is in ruins."
Thank you very much.
But we shouldn't feel bad about that, evidently.
No, I think although my life is in ruins, it's definitely a good life.
So what created the original impetus for you? What was the fascination with looking at crumbling structures and old civilizations that didn't still exist?
You know, I was a child of the 80s. This is a time before cable television and the internet, and I think, you know, partly it was getting National Geographic. Maybe it was the second time the King Tut exhibit came through the U.S. and there was a lot of media about it. I've just loved archaeology ever since I was a tiny child. And, you know, I in the 80s, I had no idea that my career would end up being, you know, as an archaeologist and also using new technologies.
Tell us about the influence your grandfather had on your choice of career.
So my grandfather, Harold Young, was a forestry professor at the University of Maine in Orono, but he was one of the pioneers in using aerial photography in forestry. Starting in the 1940s and into the 1950s, he'd use it to measure tree heights and look for different kinds of tree species. And we sort of take this for granted today. It's like, oh, well, you know, we all use Google Earth. What's the big deal? But in the 40s and 50s, you know, this was really cutting-edge technology that he learned about as a paratrooper, serving as an officer in the 101st Screaming Eagles in World War II. And so he took this technology, he applied it to his research, and he was the reason that I took my first remote sensing course as an undergraduate almost 20 years ago.
Did Harold Young live long enough to see and appreciate Google Earth?
Unfortunately, he passed away about 20 years ago. So you know, he definitely saw satellites beginning to be used in forestry, but he'd long since retired from his career. So, unfortunately, he didn't get to see all the applications, but I think he got a pretty good sense of where things were going.
Indeed. I guess we should mention Indiana Jones as an influence, too, although, you know, we do have a regular archaeology segment here on the Jefferson Exchange, and we're reminded often that the Indiana Jones thing kind of gives hives to some archaeologists, but it did have a function of inspiring you.
It did look like, you know, I was what, 4 or 5 years old when I started watching it. I, you know, at the time I didn't know necessarily how problematic it was, and I certainly understand that in spades today. But the reality is that movie inspired so many archaeologists in my generation to, you know, to enter the field, to take college courses. And I spend part of the book talking about, you know, its problematic nature, but I, you know, it's a movie, it's a product of its time. And let's face it, who knew that melting Nazis would still be relevant in 2019?
Really? Oh, well said. So Indiana Jones didn't have a lot of air support. The planes are pretty primitive in his movies, but let's talk about space archaeology. How long has it been possible to do this?
So, you know, the field of space archaeology, I mean, it's my fun public outreach name. I guess if you want to be technical, it's mid-troposphere multispectral pixel analysis of ancient landscapes, and now all your listeners are asleep. It's really referring to the field of remote sensing and archaeology, so using different imagery, like whether it's satellite imagery or imagery taken from an airplane, to basically look back at Earth and look for these very subtle differences on the Earth's surface. We're looking for both shapes and patterns that may indicate a potential settlement or feature, but also we're using different parts of the light spectrum, almost like a sort of space-based CAT scan, that allow us to see subtle differences on the surface that may suggest what's beneath the ground.
So did it start as a hack? I mean, was it a new use for an existing technology?
Yeah, so you know, the field of aerial archaeology has been around over 100 years. It was first used in 1908 from a tethered balloon, photographs taken from a tethered balloon at Stonehenge. And then for many, many years, of course, archaeologists use aerial photographs. And it really wasn't until satellites were launched in the early 1970s that this field became possible. Certainly developed on from aerial photography. And it was really starting in the 80s that archaeologists started seeing the potential of the technology. But I would say, and if you'll excuse the pun, it's really taken off in the last 15 or so years. And I dare say it's become a pretty common archaeological tool now.
So, Sarah, what are the places, what are the circumstances in which you would use it? I mean, I guess if you're looking for a couple of cabins in the wilderness, that they might not necessarily be useful for this, but is it for larger sorts of things?
So you use it depending on what you're doing. So let's just say, you know, you're working in Central America and your goal is to map the Maya Empire, which of course extended over, you know, millions of square kilometers. How are you going to begin to look for anything? You know, you're dealing with an area that's dense rainforest. And so what you want to do is you attach a sensor system called LIDAR, which stands for light detection and ranging. It's a laser mapping system. And you can use it to create a point cloud model. So basically it shoots down laser beams or beams of energy, and you can use it to strip away the overlying vegetation. And lo and behold, you have a really detailed map of thousands and thousands of sites and features. So you can use it to map areas where you simply wouldn't be able to map otherwise. You can use it to map large landscapes in the desert or elsewhere because, you know, it's either hard to get there or it's just not feasible to go mapping on the ground. But also you can use it, you know, from many, many miles away to determine what's on a site itself, whether it's a buried temple or an entire settlement.
Much more to learn about from Sarah Parkak, who's teaching us about mid-troposphere multi-level pixel analysis. And yes, you can see why she calls the book Archaeology from Space, How the Future Shapes Our Past. We'll talk more with Sarah and take phone calls and emails from you if you'd like to join us when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 25. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Sarah Parkak is our guest. She's a professor of anthropology at the University of Alabama, Birmingham. She has more or less pioneered the field of space archaeology, looking down from satellites to do some analysis of what shows up in the images from above. It's certainly been done a long time ago. She mentioned the balloons being used at Stonehenge, but taken to a new level with satellites and all the things that they are capable of doing in our day and age. You can join the conversation as we talk about archaeology from space at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We're talking about the kinds of things you can see from above, the patterns and shapes and things like that. But so what, for example, did you learn about Giza, where the Great Pyramids are, that you didn't already know?
So, yeah, I we did a study at Giza, which, of course, is one of the most you know, recognizable and visited archaeological sites in the world, the only remaining great wonder of the ancient world. And there are many, many hundreds of tombs that are there. These are officials that would have lived and worked in the court of the king about 4,400 plus years ago. And we had all this data from existing excavations, and using satellite imagery, we found a couple potential tombs that didn't seem to be in any previous records. So there could, even at a site as well explored and known as Giza, there could still be tombs that are left to be discovered.
And so what, again, are you seeing on the satellite images that indicate the presence of these things?
So in archaeology, we go from the known to the unknown, and wherever in the world we work, whether it's Egypt or Peru or India, it just doesn't matter where, we develop detailed databases of all the features that are known at that site, whether it's different kinds of tombs or temples or houses, and we then get satellite imagery, process it, and we're trying to bring out very subtle differences on the surface that indicate what's under the ground, probably by the buildings degrading, and you pick up these subtle chemical differences. And so in a place like Giza, we're looking for right angles. In other words, buildings or structures that align with buildings that are already excavated. And that's really what we look for anywhere in the world.
Your first visit to Giza, this is an aside, how does the Macarena figure in the story?
Oh, Thank you for bringing that up. So my first trip to Egypt, which was actually exactly 20 years ago, you know, I was a college student at the time. I went on this wild trip by myself, which I'm looking back and going, why did I do something that foolish? But I ended up, via some people I met in Aswan, getting invited on this unbelievable luxury cruise. They didn't really charge me much for it. And it was a group of primarily elderly Taiwanese tourists, and at the time the Macarena was very popular. So I ended up on my first trip to Egypt teaching a group of elderly Taiwanese tourists, mostly women, the Macarena on a cruise ship. It was a crazy evening. I will never forget it.
It's a lot of fun. I'm glad you included it in the book. So back to the science here. The archaeological sites is a really interesting thing you say here, that they're like film strips. How so?
So in other words, you know, with a film strip, you're looking, maybe if you put like a film strip or like one, you know, now of course it's all digital, but you know, 0.01 seconds next to 0.02 seconds, you can't really see enormous differences between them, but maybe you go from 0.01 to 0.04 and then arms have moved or legs have moved and things are slightly out of place. That's how the archaeological record unfolds. You know, as you're digging down, as you're going through layer by layer, I liken it to, you know, going through multiple layers of 3D time capsules, one stacked atop the other. You know, maybe between one layer and a second layer, you're not seeing huge differences, but between the first layer and the third layer, you are. And so it's by kind of piecing together all these subtle differences, these changes in pottery and the material culture we excavate and the different layers of dirt, that we're able to piece together the story of what happened at a site. And, you know, slowly over time, we're able to tell its story.
So as you move vertically into the ground, you have to be really careful, it sounds like, to figure out where a layer ends, or are they somewhat mixed sometimes?
It depends. Sometimes you get really clear differences in the soil. You'll get a really dense clay type layer atop a more rocky, rubbly, sandy layer, and okay, the differences are clear, but sometimes your layers morph into each other, and so we use something called a section. So it's a flat bit of earth, and it's almost like you're able to read the layers and see the changes right in front of you. So you're very, very carefully making sure not to blow through a whole 3D time capsule. It's really tough work. It's not easy. You know, we make mistakes. It's okay. We learn. We try to do better. But it's also super fun because, let's face it, you know, it's like your inner five-year-old never goes away.
Right, truly. Sarah Parkak is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is Archaeology from Space, How the Future Shapes Our Past. I'm fascinated by the things that you can learn from pretty much all the stuff you dig up, but from the bones of people who've been long dead. There's a story you tell in the book about the skeleton of a woman at Tel Tabila in Egypt.
Oh, yes. Yeah, this woman was excavated at a site in the Delta. We know nothing about her. It's, you know, just a skeleton from a woman in her 50s or an older woman. And that's it. That's all we know. So I love the idea of using artifacts and objects and things excavated to bring people back to life. And so I essentially spun out the story of this anonymous woman's life from 4,200 years ago. So I named her Merit, which is an Egyptian name that means, ancient Egyptian name that means the beloved. And I told the story of how she survived this great period of climate change and political instability at the end of Egypt's Great Pyramid Age. Fictional, but largely based in a pretty serious amount of archaeological information.
Still, with all the stuff you can figure out and with all the tools at our disposal now technologically, it sounds like there are still many gaps that you have to fill with theories. It's not like this stuff actually gets up and tells you a story.
I only wish it did. You know, a great exercise I make my students do in introductory archaeology classes, I make them empty out their pockets or a pocket of their choosing, lest their pocket contain something they don't want to share with the class. And we use all the information on the desk to try to recreate the story of life today. And that's a pretty good exercise in that we only end up with fragments of information from the past. There are so many things that get lost or destroyed. And we're just trying to use all the information, digging slowly, collecting everything, quantifying everything, putting all that information together to try to tell the stories of what happened. And at the end of the day, you know, we're using all this to the best of our ability, and it's still a lot of guesswork, but educated guesswork.
It occurs to me at this moment that the fact that there is no such place as Away, which is often mentioned by people who are concerned about solid waste, helps archaeology because people couldn't throw their stuff far enough away to it not have any record of it.
Yeah, I joke. I say that Tupperware is the ceramic of the modern world. we're going to, someday there will be future plasticologists, and they're going to understand how our society worked by looking at how the plastic evolved through time. Hopefully, we'll stop using plastic soon. But yeah, you know, we essentially are excavating people's garbage. It's really important because, of course, that gives a sense of what people were like, what they used, classes of people, the rich, the poor, you know, and those are the interesting stories that we like to tell.
Well, I'm concerned about the plastic, but I must admit there's a certain sort of giggling about the idea of future generations trying to figure out how to match the lids and the bottoms like we do now.
Yeah, I apologize in advance to future generations of PhD students who develop plastic typologies. No thank you. But then again, you know, like, there are people that spend their dissertations looking at pottery and pottery, how pottery changes through time, and that's the most important thing that we excavate on our projects.
Right. Are the patterns that you see from above, I mean, when you get satellite or other aerial imagery, do they see patterns that are just not apparent on the ground?
Correct. So when you're walking over the ground on a site, you know, maybe sometimes there are subtle hints, especially in the morning, you know, when it's a bit more damp on sites, maybe you see a hint of something. But for the most part, you know, especially in places like Egypt, you're walking over walking over dusty soil, and you can't see anything. And what the satellites do is they allow you to pull back and get some perspective. Now, you can't always see things buried beneath the ground from space. It always depends on, you know, the imagery and the time of year you take it. But more often than not, you can, and it gives you a good sense of where to start excavating.
You got to dig in a corner, in fact, at Tel Tabila and almost gave up, you say. What happened as you went on just a little further?
So that was a really fun project. So we used 1960s high-resolution black-and-white spy photography that was taken as a result of the U.S. Cold War with Russia. And in 1995, then-President Bill Clinton declassified all the imagery, so it preserves landscapes from space that, of course, no longer really exist or have largely changed. And so we got this imagery of Tel Tabila, and we used it to find the ancient temple enclosure wall from 2,600 years ago. And I got to excavate in the corner, because corners are typically where cool things happen on sites, especially in big walls. And as I was going down, I found all this burnt brick. I didn't think it was very important, but all of a sudden these little glints of gold started showing up, and then all these semi-precious stones. And so in carefully excavating, what I realized is that when the Persians attacked the site in 343 BC, they'd probably gone into the temple, they'd collected the temple idols, they'd thrown them in the corner and set them on fire. And what we were seeing was the evidence in this corner of 2,400-year-old site destruction.
So when you find something, how do you know when to stop digging, that you think you've got the picture of what happened there?
You know when to stop digging because your season is ending in 2 days. That's typically it.
You have to go back and teach class again.
You got to go back, or money has run out. So yeah, we very carefully plan our excavation projects, because even though there's a lot we can see from space or ground-based remote sensing, you know, we can't just dig and dig and dig. You know, it has to be very carefully targeted. We're answering hypotheses that we've proposed both to our funders as well as to, say, the Egyptian government. We're very clear about what we have as our goals for the season. So at some point, you do have to stop, because if you keep digging until the last day, what are you going to do with all the pottery and objects you find? So we're pretty careful about timing things and wrapping things up so that we can process stuff before we go home.
Sarah Parkak is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, professor of anthropology at the University of Alabama, Birmingham, TED Prize winner, National Geographic Explorer, and the author of the book Archaeology from Space, How the Future Shapes Our Past. Yes, we're talking about satellite imagery and other aerial photos being used to give greater interpretation to dig sites. Join us on the Exchange with questions, comments, 800-838-3760 by phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Roy in Eugene used email to write in, do you use LIDAR surveys to refine course data from satellite surveys? Also, please say a bit about how you integrate data from multiple sources. Thanks for that, Roy.
That's a great question. Thank you for asking. So, yeah, so first of all, we use as much information as we can. So different high-resolution satellite platforms, different sensors. Of course, we're using technology and satellites from NASA as well. And basically, we input a bunch of satellite images into our imagery processing programs, and we're comparing them one next to the other. Maybe an image from the spring shows up a few things, but the image from the fall shows up completely different things. So we're constantly comparing the imagery. Now, we don't use LIDAR everywhere. It's really expensive to capture it. To the extent that I can, I'll use it at sites. But I'm lucky in Egypt. For the most part, you're dealing with an open landscape, so we don't necessarily need LIDAR to see beneath vegetation. But colleagues of mine will certainly use both satellite imagery and LIDAR. But I'm very, very excited about its future potential, especially with 3D mapping of sites.
Who trains people to figure out what's what?
When you're excavating, when you're going through all this information, it's a process. When I started, there was so much, of course, I didn't know. I had to develop catalogs of what different features on sites looked like from space. And that's really what we do wherever we go. We're constantly looking at, if we're looking, say, in Iceland, what does a 10th century or, sorry, 11th century, Norse farmhouse look like versus a medieval farmhouse? And then it's just a process of trial and error. And I should say, I never work in a vacuum. I'm always working with teams of collaborators, which is always the way to do this kind of work. So I'm always getting a lot of feedback about what's working and what's not working.
Sarah, do you get lots of false positives? A lot of like, oh my God, we found a, oh no, we didn't.
Yeah, welcome to every day of my research. I get way too overly excited. Most of the time when you're looking at satellite imagery, you're really not seeing very much. This is science. I tell people science is a process of iterative failure. 99.99%+ of the time, you're just looking at imagery, you're processing it. Maybe you see a subtle hint of a shape, and you put a little dot on the map to come back to it, and then it turns out it was nothing. Sometimes, yeah, you definitely see shapes of things. There was one instance where we looked at imagery and we thought we'd found a Viking longhouse in Scotland, and it was exactly the same size and shape and orientation as other Viking longhouses in the area. And randomly, a local sheep farmer had come in and cut out turf in the exact shape of a Viking longhouse. And we're like, really? Really? That's amazing. And we didn't find that out until a colleague went on the ground. And it's just like, that happens. This is science. So you just sort of regroup and move on.
We have a phone call here from Paul in Grants Pass. Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange with Sarah Parkak. Her book is Archaeology from Space.
Good morning. We have so much to learn from this. Two questions. First of all, does this LIDAR pierce water? Can you do any exploration of the continental shelves, lake beds, things along those lines? That's one question. And then the other question is just kind of a fun question. What is the most amazing thing that you found so far?
Okay, thanks for that, Paul.
Both great questions. Yeah, I get asked about underwater archaeology a fair bit. So as of right now, the challenge with most water is that you get a lot of what's called specular reflection. So think of the surface of water like a mirror, of course, it's reflecting light. And you can't always get that LIDAR to pierce it. This is why things like sonar are used by archaeologists and geologists to be able to map the ocean floor. Some of my colleagues have successfully used satellite imagery to map things like shipwrecks on the ocean floor. And what they do is, with all the water turbidity, so the movement of the of sediments in the water, they're actually mapping the plumes of sediment that are around shipwrecks. And you're able to see the outline of those shipwrecks from the water plumes or plumes of sediment, and that can be seen from the satellite imagery. So it's really, really cool. I think it's something like 2 or 3 million shipwrecks that are said to be out there. So yeah, I think we have a lot to see from the development of these technologies. I've been so lucky to be able to work in many, many different places in the world. Probably personally, my favorite thing that I've been able to map is the city of Tanis, which was Egypt's capital over 3,000 years ago. From the satellite imagery, we were able to map out the entirety of its settlement. I think it's a great contribution to my field. But yeah, I mean, I'm very lucky. I've gotten to work in so many different places, so it's always hard to pick my favorite.
Do a lot more satellites come online all the time? You get all sorts of new sources of potential imagery?
Yeah, that can be the big challenge with all these new sensor systems being launched, some high resolution, some lower resolution. You know, we want to be able to test what's out there, and it's a big challenge. And we're only, I think, a few years away from having a resolution of maybe 3 to 6 inches from hundreds of miles in space.
Wow, 3 to 6 inches from way up there. The book is called Archaeology from Space, How the Future Shapes Our Past. Author Sarah Parkak is with us on The Exchange, and she'll return with your phone calls and emails in a minute 25. Sarah Parkak is really into archaeology and has been for a very long time. She's met Harrison Ford and swapped stories about Indiana Jones. She has won the TED Prize in 2016 for her work on space archaeology, gotten to go on Stephen Colbert's show to talk about it. She's written a book about what she does called Archaeology from Space, How the Future Shapes Our Past. It's a conversation you're welcome to join here on the Jefferson Exchange by phone at 800-838-3760, by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So a further refinement of the concept that the things that are below the ground will change the appearance of things above the ground, even as a lot of time has passed, you get into the discussion of crop marks. I'm glad you got here. What does make those marks in fields, and for how long?
So imagine that you're, you have a Roman villa made of stone. You know, of course, only the foundations remain somewhere in a field in Italy, and walking over the surface of the field, you can't really see anything. It's a field. Maybe there's some kind of crop or vegetation there. But what happens is the roots of that crop will go down and they'll hit the stone wall. And the crop, therefore, won't be able to absorb as much water or any other nutrients. And so it will be slightly less healthy than the vegetation around it. Now, we can't see that visually, but vegetation contains chlorophyll, and you can look at chlorophyll content in the near-infrared, which is, of course, something we can't see. And so by getting satellite imagery with the near-infrared and processing it, all of a sudden you see a complete rectangle or outline of what was a settlement. So whatever's under the ground is going to affect the overlaying vegetation or soil or sand in ways that more often than not we can't see, and that's why we need satellites.
So understand, though, that we need to understand the full spectrum shot, not just the infrared. You wouldn't notice anything, but only with the infrared you would?
Correct. So, you know, and maybe in some instances, say during a really, really dry time of year, maybe these differences would pop out. You know, I think of the droughts that happened in England last summer, when archaeologists were sending up drones left, right, and center because there was no rain for weeks and weeks and weeks. And apparently hundreds of archaeological features, from Iron Age hill forts to medieval structures, just showed up because there was so much there was a lack of water.
Wow. So you mentioned the beginning of all this was somebody taking pictures from a balloon of Stonehenge, and we got the aerial view, and oh, look at that. The orientation becomes a bit different to us. Let's give credit, though, to Mary Marguerite Scalera for her prediction about space archaeology. Who was she?
So she was an intern who worked at NASA in the 1970s, in the late 1970s, and she was working in an office and sort of looking at all these new technologies that were available. And she got really, really excited about the potential of satellite imagery for archaeology, and I admit I spent a lot of time trying to chase her down. I contacted people at NASA. I wanted to do an interview with her because this is an amazing woman who predicted an entire field. And so I, of course, wanted to give her credit and visibility in the book. So if any of your listeners happen to have any connections to her, please get her in contact with me. I'd love to speak to her.
Okay, still looking for Mary Marguerite Scalera. The use of the imagery from above, you gave us a flyby a bit ago about trying to look for evidence of Maya civilization, for example. So where you're often dealing with things in Egypt, and I want to talk about Lisht a bit later, where this is a place in the desert where there, you know, it's dusty, dry, dirt over it and all that stuff. But then you get a different kind of situation in the Americas where the jungle kind of grows over things. As satellite archaeology proved helpful there too?
Yes. So this is work being done by my colleagues, Marcel Canuto and Francisco Estrada Belli at Tulane University as part of the Panacum Initiative. And archaeologists from across Central America who focus on the Maya have kind of banded together, and multiple colleagues working at multiple sites are getting many thousands of square kilometers of data and information collected from LIDAR. And so Marcel and Francisco and others processed this imagery in Guatemala, and they were able to find 60,000 new features at the famous site of Tikal alone, which is just unbelievable. And they've been able to map thousands and thousands of other sites and features across the region. So for the first time, you know, we're about to have a complete map of the archaeology of the Maya region.
Wow. So that's the broad view. But then, of course, there's still digging going to go on. And I'm struck by when you write in the book about the value of archaeology in interpretation, about how people lived. And you say on that front, you'd rather see old bread loaves than gold. Why?
So, you know, gold is nice. And it's pretty, and it shines, and you ooh and you ah, and you're like, okay, that was owned probably by a rich person, and that's it. Versus you look at bread, and all of a sudden, you know, it's like, okay, what kind of bread is it, and where does the wheat come from, and how is it made, and who made it, and are there bakeries, and who were the bakeries for? How much bread was consumed? How was bread? I mean, I could go on and on and on and on. So it allows us to ask so many more questions, I think, about that culture. I'm much, much more interested in the evidence of everyday life in antiquity.
So what are some of the major gaps we have about some of the things that went on in ancient Egypt, the things that you're trying to dig up at Lisht?
So compared to the Old Kingdom, you know, Egypt's Great Pyramid Age, and the New Kingdom, which was Egypt's Great Imperial Age, you know, comparatively speaking, we don't have as much information about the Middle Kingdom, which was ancient Egypt's Renaissance, this great period of art and architecture. And if you take a course in Middle Egyptian at a university, you're learning the language that was spoken and written during the Middle Kingdom. So this would have been 3,800 years ago. So with the collaborative work I'm doing at Lisht with the Ministry of Antiquities, we're helping to flesh out this period of time about which comparatively we do know very little.
I imagine you have to have some context in hand. I mean, do you just get satellite imagery and try to figure out later what's going on, or do you pick a particular place you want to get satellite imagery from?
So we're very careful about where we look. So either we're working on a collaborative project with a team that's doing work on the ground, and they're interested in, say, learning about the landscape surrounding them, or they're learning about or interested in learning more information about their site, or we have a particular research question. So say in this part of Egypt, we're very interested in learning about how the Nile shifted and changed over time in comparison to settlements or other features. So we always go into the work with a research question or research questions. We never just go somewhere and start looking, although certainly I get a lot of emails weekly from people that have just randomly found things on Google Earth. But we personally, you know, we always go into this with research questions.
Okay, so it's not just a like, hey, let's see what we can find there. It's like, you know, what happened there is what you're looking for.
Yeah, correct.
You've done a fair amount of work with TV people, as you note, and I was going to only giggle at some of the frustrations you experienced with BBC producers. It sounds like they want to do this Al Capone's vault thing with you or something, like get things to reveal on camera.
Yeah, and that's, you know, it's not how science works. You know, I had to deal with a couple directors who wanted my quote-unquote emotional reaction, and I was like, would you want this from a man? Because I don't think so. You know, I people have this vision that I get all teary-eyed and gasp when I'm, you know, looking at imagery and I find something, and like, I this is my work, this is what I do every day. I found tens of thousands of things. I mean, it's nice, and I may smile, but, you know, to me, that's it's not about, I tell people, it's not about what we find, it's about what we find out. You know, a thing is part of hundreds of things that allows me to ask bigger, better questions about the archaeological record, and that's what gets me really, really excited. So I think it makes great TV. You know, yeah, Al Capone's vault, like none of this live reveal stuff ever usually goes well. I think the stories are what makes it fascinating, and I just wish TV folks would focus on that more.
Do the TV folks tend to go for the sexy things, though, and therefore limit some other places you might want to dig or look?
Yeah, I think it's partly, you know, it's partly how television works. You know, I think I like to give a shout out to PBS Nova because their documentaries are always outstanding. You know, the BBC for the most part does a pretty good job. Yeah, I think a lot of television shows like Sensational, which is it's just not okay. You know, it's people, in all the TV work I've done, people always get most excited about learning about how people were just like us thousands of years ago.
There's a really big point in this section, which is that the reason that we find older settlements under newer ones is because people need the same kinds of things in the places they choose to live.
Correct. You know, when you think about places like Athens or Rome or Istanbul or Cairo, I call those places layered cities because people are living in the same places that they've been living for thousands of years. I mean, look at what happened, you know, when the Olympics were in Athens and they tried to dig down to create a new tramline or subway system, and they kept hitting archaeology. Of course they did. People have been living in Athens for three, you know, 2,000+ years. So yeah, I think it's fascinating to me that we, you know, as much as we move around in our increasingly globalized world, more often than not, people are just living in the same places that we've always lived.
So obviously you do find many layers of stuff there. So back to the sky stuff, though, the archaeology from space. You mentioned some filters like infrared. I mean, how many different kinds of things can you apply to the basic visuals?
So the imagery that we use, the processing techniques that we use are the same types of tools and technologies that, say, biologists would use to look at places where animals might live. It's the same thing that scientists are using to study melting polar ice caps or ocean level rise. So the techniques are the same. It's the field of remote sensing as a whole. But what we're doing is whether we're looking at different parts of the light spectrum, whether we're using different kinds of filtering to try to detect the edges of features, you know, we'll try everything at our disposal to really try to bring out these features. And it's never just one technique that all of a sudden is going to reveal your features. It's multiple techniques applied over time.
And Sarah, some of space archaeology appears to be defensive in nature. Are we still talking about major threats from looters?
Oh, goodness, yes. You know, sites all over the world are threatened by looting in the U.S. and South America and the Middle East and China, everywhere. You know, and it's not just the looters. Looting is a problem. It's modern development and urbanization. That's actually even a greater threat to sites. Modern development is just erasing sites everywhere. So, you know, but at least from the satellite imagery, we can track where this is going on, and at least we can determine areas that are most under threat.
So here's where I want to talk about Global Explorer. What was your vision for it?
So I founded Global Explorer a little over 3 years ago, and it is an organization dedicated to using cutting-edge technologies to empower the world to find our shared human heritage. We built a crowdsourcing citizen archaeology platform, also called Global Explorer. It allows anyone in the world, I joke, I say all kids between 5 and 105, to look at satellite imagery and help us find archaeological sites. We launched in Peru, and now we're going to India. And to date, we've had, I think we're coming up on close to 90,000 users from over 120 countries. And they've looked at, I want to say, 16 or 17 million satellite images, and they found almost 20,000 potential archaeological features.
Wow. I was going to ask you the success rate. That's, so you got all these eyes looking at that, 90,000 users looking at the images and coming up with a lot of possible sites.
Correct. And to me, the most exciting part, because you're like, oh, okay, like, you know, it's great, they're finding things, but could this be useful on the ground? And what we've been doing is we've been very carefully sharing that information with our colleagues in Peru. And one of our colleagues, Dr. Luis Jaime Castillo, who was just last week named the Minister of Culture in Peru, he's a world expert in using drone mapping. And so we gave Luis Jaime and his team results from the platform. He went out with his team to do drone survey of these sites. And as a side project, he was able to map 50 new Nazca lines in the Nazca region. So this idea that the information from the platform can empower really sharp, forward-thinking archaeologists on the ground, I mean, that's a huge goal for us, and we're thrilled that that result happened.
So some citizen archaeology, in a sense. Is it something of an arms race between the archaeologists and the looters?
I would say so. You know, my colleague, Tom Seaver, who for years worked at NASA as an archaeologist, said, I want to say it was almost 40 years ago, he said, if we don't start using this technology, the pot hunters are going to beat us to it. So he warned us. He warned us 35, 40 years ago. And I'm sure that they're using things like Google Earth. How could they not be?
Indeed. Okay, so globalexplorer.org, just the X, globalexplorer.org is the site to go to. The book is called Archaeology from Space, How the Future Shapes Our Past. It's the work of Sarah Parkak, who's a professor of anthropology at the University of Alabama, Birmingham, also the founder and president of Global Explorer. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.